This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's access media station, Plains FM, and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Welcome to Terra Nova Earth Talks. We speak with cutting-edge experts and wise elders from across the globe on the issues and action our Earth is calling for. Brought to you by the Terra Nova Foundation, driving environmental change through human connection and collective action.
We are at a time of unprecedented global environmental change. Much of the conversations around global changes is around carbon and the impact that this has made and will make in our future. However, just talking about carbon doesn't quite do the global context justice. The impact of human behaviour, our interaction with this earth, has created massive imbalances on multiple scores. Insatiable consumption in many nations is still being encouraged. Pollution of our waters and our oceans is increasing, often with little consequence for those polluting. And we insist on continuing practices that take away vast amounts of our most precious biodiversity, creating huge imbalances on biospheric levels. Such pictures are hard to palette, and it's sometimes challenging to even make a dent in them, or it can seem so, let alone turn them around. However, there are many people around the world doing just that, leading the way on awareness, not just of the issues, but of the action to take and the role we can play to support it. We are very fortunate today to have one such person in the studio, the esteemed explorer and leading environmental scientist, Tim Jarvis. You may have seen Tim on one of his groundbreaking documentary films or read one of his extraordinary books, giving insight into his adventures around the world. Or you may have heard about his expedition that created Sir Ernest Shackleton's epic 1916 crossing of the Southern Ocean, using the same equipment, the same clothing, and food as the original expedition party. He is here with us today, and it's a great privilege. He's a member of the Order of Australia for his service to conservation and the environment. And yes, we're so fortunate to have him here today. Tim, welcome. And thank you so much for being here with Terra Nova Earth Talks.
Thank you. And thank you for providing the weather that makes me feel it so at home. It's been cold.
Yes.
Cold but fresh.
We're in Ōtautahi today on a very crisp morning. So, yes, the gateway to the Antarctic couldn't be more.
That's right. It's well and truly open.
Right, so I've got some questions for you, Tim, and relevant to your exploration, but also to the environmental role that you have taken over the years. But first of all, I'm really curious to know, how does one become such an intrepid explorer? Is it something you took up in childhood and just kept challenging yourself from then on? Or is it more sort of in your blood, it's like part of who you are?
That's a very good question. How does one become an explorer? First of all, I don't call myself one. I just sort of regard myself as who I am, really. But I guess as a child, I'd always spent time outdoors and enjoyed my own company, enjoyed the love of being in nature, of solving problems and becoming more resilient, which sort of comes with that territory. And then over the years, you end up with a sort of dawning realization that the nature you love so much actually is under considerable threat. And then further down the line, you start to realize that the profile you have in the outdoor space allows you the opportunity to not only bring images back of those places, but also distill some lessons about how we can better protect them and use what profile you have to try and make change, positive change happen. And then you find you've come full circle. You realise that your love of nature has led you to do expeditions, which in turn have lessons which help you protect that place. So it's a virtuous circle. But I couldn't tell you a time when it just dawned on me to do that. I guess I've always done it.
Yeah, as part of the journey. You're quite an international citizen. You've grown up in different places. Can you tell a little bit about growing up?
Well, yes. You know, I was born in the UK, but I moved to Malaysia as a young kid with my parents. And I lived there till I was 12 in Malaysia at the time. Giving away my age was, you know, in the 70s. And, you know, monkeys and wild dogs and tin mining dredges you could climb up and make camps on and, you know, snakes and interesting things and learning Bahasa, the Malay language, and having friends from completely different sort of circumstances. And it helped form my, you know, childhood version of who I felt I was, I guess. And then I went to Singapore as a kid in my teens. I went to a United World College, which was a Kurt Hahn school. Kurt Hahn was an international educator who believed in learning by doing and internationalism and environmentalism and all that kind of thing. He founded Gordonston School in the UK, which is where the Duke of Edinburgh scheme that many young people go through because it was all about his ethos of how to teach and how to learn. And then I moved to Australia in 97 after uni in the UK and lots of things in between. And Australia is a land of great opportunity in many respects, but plenty of room for improvement on the environment side. And I found that it gave me tremendous opportunity to sort of see where positive change could happen and a big playground to go out and enjoy.
And quite extreme ecosystems too, you know, from you've got lush marine environments in
really
Australia
extreme.
Right through the desert. So
really extreme. And it's a big place. And but we do have the highest rate of native species loss in the developed world, which is nothing
amazing
to be proud of. And I think a lot of Aussies don't know that. And so it's important to, you know, work with partners to try and do something about that.
So I want to just dive in a little bit, because as an explorer, I think the thing that we, definitely personally don't have a lot of experiences is going to places where there's very few people or no one at all, which I think gives you a different perception, if you like, of the Earth. How has it given you any insight into the Earth that perhaps other people wouldn't have experienced?
I think going to remote places gives you gives you reflection time. So it takes you away from all the noise of day-to-day life and society. And so many aspects of who you think you are as a person are defined by how people react to you. You can be a brother or a sister or a mother or an aunt or a particular level of seniority in a corporate organization or a good runner, and people react to you accordingly, and that gives you the opportunity to kind of form an opinion of who you think you are. But you go to the Antarctic and you spend 3 months on your own, and it helps you find out more, and it helps you see human society for all its good and bad from a distance, and maybe see things with a bit more clarity. So that's the first thing I'd say. And the second thing is, I think you see the human footprint even out in those most remote places, and it makes you realize just where we're at as a society and how we need to pull our heads in a bit and change the way we do things.
Yeah, no, I definitely want to ask you about that, because quite often, especially when we're getting scientific data, Antarctic comes up quite a lot. And I know you know, it's not a place we are very familiar with. It's not like we're popping down there for a holiday every now and then. And so sometimes the significance of the Antarctic and the science that's coming out of there isn't always apparent to, you know, me sitting at home. I'm just wondering if you can give, you know, you've got a significant scientific background, a scientific mind, but also scientific background. Can you give some insight into the Antarctic and what some of the changes have that are happening down there? Why does it matter? Why do we need to know?
Well, I mean, look, Antarctica is a big place for a start. It's 52 times the size of New Zealand, and the average ice thickness is over 2 km. Average, some places it's 5. And of all the world's water, we have the majority in the ocean, 97%, and of the remaining 3, 2 is actually in the Antarctic ice. So in the ice cap, we've got 70 metres of global sea level rise right there.
Wow.
Now, that's not all going to melt tomorrow. but even small proportions of it, particularly the western part of Antarctica, which is warming very, very rapidly, that's 7 metres of sea level rise just in that bit. That has huge repercussions for us globally, not just here in New Zealand, but also Indonesia, where we have 17,500 islands and a lot of people living within a metre of the high sea level mark as it currently stands. So, you know, sea level rise from Antarctica is a major issue. And, of course, Antarctica is such a massive ice with this reflective surface of white that if it goes or diminishes in any way, shape or form, you've got a tremendous amount of additional heat getting in. Same applies to the Arctic, in fact, even more so with the Arctic, in fact, because that's sea ice just on top of a dark ocean. Once that sea ice goes, which we're suggesting it will by 2037, you've got a lot more incoming heat just being absorbed by the ocean. And that then impacts global weather patterns, because weather is caused really by, you know, the differential heating of the Earth's surface caused by a whole bunch of things. But that differential heating of the Earth's surface causes all the currents that we know about and all the wind, and that in turn determines the weather. So, you know, we're up for a lot of change as a result of these places really changing, which is scary. The good news is I think we save places like that not by going to the Antarctic or the High Arctic. We save it back in places like Christchurch, where we're speaking from, where, you know, the majority of us live in cities, and that's where we consume the food and where we move around and where we produce all the carbon emissions which are causing these problems. So the good news is changes we need to make are back here where all of us live, not down there.
So the Antarctic is really, it's like a massive red flag.
It's the litmus paper, I think, for planetary health, because no one lives there really. I mean, there's scientists, but there's very small numbers.
Yeah, and it's just quite mind-boggling. So you said 2 to 5 kilometres deep.
Yeah.
The ice. I think that's sometimes hard to get your head around, right?
It is.
That's a long way down into...
When you think it's, you know, like I say, 52 times the size of New Zealand, it's 14 million square kilometres in physical extent, and then 2050 actually is the average ice thickness. So you've got 30 million cubic kilometres of ice.
Yeah.
And 1 cubic kilometre is a big cube.
Yeah.
You know, you've got 30 million of those. So it's, the scale is very difficult to appreciate. Even the biggest iceberg that broke off was 15 times the size of Singapore.
Yes.
You know, there's B15, and I've seen bits of that still floating around. It broke off decades ago, and it's still so large that it's still wandering the ocean.
Presumably getting smaller as it wanders.
Getting smaller. As it gets smaller, the different fragments are called A, B, C, D, based on their size. And I saw B15A back in 2006, and it's still washing around.
I think they need better names.
They're not very...
They should name them, actually.
They're not very... Well, they are scientists, right?
So, oh, of course.
They're not very evocative.
Yeah. They need process.
Could be called the Beast or something like that, but it's called B15A,
So you have to. We've already just touched on some of the action we can take, but I want to dive into that now, because you haven't just raised awareness of issues around the world. And for those who aren't aware, Tim here has been an ambassador for WWF. He's spoken at the UN Climate Change, the COP conference, and to raise some of the awareness on a significant and really in a really critical way, which is super important to the big picture. But you've also been proactive and taken action yourself on a number of fronts. Can you share with us some of the action you've taken and why you've taken that particular action? Because, you know, I think you've seen a lot. There's a lot that you could do. So you must have really had a conscious process to decide what can I do that's going to be significant?
Yeah, look, I think... there are many ways to answer that question, but I think in carbon accounting, they talk about the lowest cost source of abatement. In other words, how can you get a ton of carbon out of the atmosphere as cheaply as possible if you're trying to reduce your carbon footprint? And, you know, that's a kind of an accounting exercise. I almost run the same process with myself, saying I've got a limited amount of time. How can I be most effective? Who should I be working with to get as much CO2 out of the atmosphere as I can as quickly as possible? So you work with certain industry sectors and certain corporates and certain governments who you think are prepared to prepared to change. Just jumping around a bit, I mean, I think expeditions have taught me that, you know, you're always working back from the outcome you're trying to reach. When I retrace Shackleton's journey, of course, Worsley was a famous son of Akaroa, and I guess Christchurch, Canterbury, certainly. You know, you're working back from an outcome with all the things you think you need to have in place to get that thing achieved. You don't just start climbing or walking or sailing roughly in the right direction.
And we need you'll get there.
No. We need to adopt that with climate. We know the number we must reach as a global collective. What is each person's role or each country's role or each corporate organisation's role in achieving that? That kind of total. From my point of view, I did lots of stuff, but the thing I'm proud of at the moment is a reforestation project I've got called Fork Tree, based in Australia. And I do it really because there's huge interest amongst school kids and corporates to come and see positive things happening. I think we're awash in a sea of kind of negativity, so it's good to have something positive. But more than that, I see there are two bits of the climate carbon jigsaw. One is we want to stop making the problem worse, which is about things like renewable energy and electric cars, you know, emitting less. But the very real other bit, the elephant in the room for me, is who is going to be responsible for taking down all the excess CO2, which is already in the atmosphere. And that lasts several hundred years. That's all about things like tree planting and storing carbon in soil and in buildings through locking up the carbon in the fabric of the building and things like that to be climate positive, to start drawing down this stuff. And my reforestation project hopes to be an example as to how to
That's wonderful, because often these things are joined together. So it's, you know, what action to take. And it's like we've got to do redress, which is the current, you know, carbon situation. We've got to actually deal with that. Even if we're perfect human beings from now on and we behave ourselves, we've still got this massive
problem. Our
past
sins will still catch up with us. Yeah, that's right.
So there's a job to be done with that. And then there's obviously there's a job to be done around consumption, which you mentioned earlier. So with your Fork Tree project, you've got young people and businesses coming out. Do you think there's also an impact with them on connecting with the earth? One of the things I think our daily lives often take us away from any real connection. You know, we might see a tree, but that's not quite the same as going to somewhere and really immersing yourself in it. Are you getting feedback from the people that visit Fork Tree? Are they seeing beyond just the carbon reforestation?
Yeah, look, I think there's two things really going on. One is the things they can learn and the feeling they get when they come. And there's eco-anxiety, for example, amongst kids and adults. You know, so coming and planting a tree, doesn't matter what the numbers are telling us about how many trees are being lost, the act of you doing something is very empowering, and it actually really relieves that sense of eco-anxiety. So people come and they get a tremendous feeling of positivity from planting maybe 20 or 30 trees personally in the course of a day, and as a collective maybe doing 500. You know, even though we might have lost millions that day at a global level, them doing something about it really helps them deal with those sort of issues. And we've also got the fact that, you know, spending time in nature is very good for us in positive nature. We kind of know a lot about the stats around, you know, bad air quality and how bad that could be for us. But there's less research that's historically done on what the effects of a positive environment are on our mental and physical health. And now that's being spelt out quantitatively, which is really interesting. So we know that we have lower cortisol levels, lower stress levels associated with being in nature, and that's been measured. We know that we have positive impacts on our physical health associated with microbes that improve our immunity. We know that, you know, vitamin D is very good from sun and things like that. So we're starting to put numbers around why spending time outdoors is actually good for you. So you've got those two aspects. The other big piece of all this is that if a corporate organization comes, they may have nothing to do with tree planting in their day-to-day lives, but the act of coming out and talking about the issues and being part of the solution, albeit on their own personal level, makes them think, well, how can I think about what I could do back in my corporate organisation, even if it's nothing to do with trees. It normally isn't anything to do with trees, but it starts them thinking.
Yeah, what their contribution could actually be. Yeah, and it's extraordinary what people can contribute. People often say to me, you know, but I can't, you know, I'm not even able to dig a hole for a tree. What can I offer? But actually, a lot of the action that needs to be taken can be technical. It can be scientific. It can be about engineering. It can be about planning. It can be simply looking after our kids and making sure that they get outside. You know, there's so many roles that we can take, and it's going to be different for every individual.
It takes so many of us, and marketing and comms. I mean, we haven't done a very good job of marketing the urgency around climate change and putting a positive spin on what that could look like. So one of the things we do when we have forms that everybody fills in when they come and volunteer is, you know, sort of what are you good at, where are your skills, and what would you like to do? And then we try and marry up the skills they have with what they want to get out of the experience, with what we need them to do to get the job done. And to the best of our abilities, we try and do that. And, you know, everybody has something to offer because this is a multidimensional issue.
Yeah.
It takes all our skills.
And I think the thing, as you're describing the young people and businesses coming out, is when you're in an urban area, it can be incredibly noisy. And to kind of get thought that where you can step back and look at the world is actually really challenging because there's so many things going on. So I'm guessing the space, just the space, being away from things is also helpful.
Yeah, some really interesting research around this because humans, from an evolutionary point of view, have spent the vast majority of their time on the planet in nature. And that's where we're most at home. And it's only the last 10,000 years we've been in cities. And psychologists are now telling us that when we're in nature, we can pay what they call indirect attention to our surroundings. In other words, we're in a peaceful state, as long as you're not being chased by a wild animal or something like that. But for the most part, if you're in a kind of green environment, you feel really at peace. And you don't have to spend so much time assessing risk, assessing problems, which is what humans are good at. We are supercomputers that go around assessing our environment around us all the time. And you're really running your personal computer too hot if you're living in an urbanized environment. You're always on edge, even though you may not be aware of it. And now spending time in nature allows you to step away and pay this indirect attention to things. And it's good for us.
Yeah, wonderful. I'm going to wrap up now. But I have one big question. But which could take an entire podcast, but we won't. There's big issues and there's global imbalances. What do you think people can do to contribute to positive change where they are? If you had to pick some key areas that they could really contribute to, what would you say to them?
Well, my particular feeling is that climate and then the loss of global biodiversity are the two big ticket items. So involve yourself in something that does something about those areas. I think you start off with your own personal footprint. You think about where your pension money is invested. You think about how you travel, what you eat, how your home is heated or cooled. Get those bits right first up. Then think about...
And you'll feel good.
And you'll feel good. You control what you can. This is very much an expedition lesson. Control what you can, and it makes you feel kind of immeasurably better about the rest of the global situation of at least you're not part of the problem. So get that bit right. Focus on your immediate area of influence. It might be at your kid's school. It might be in your workplace. Think about how you can positively change that space. And then think about what kind of initiatives can you get involved with local to you that address those issues on a local scale. And you get to meet other people. You get to share the burden you're maybe living with of anxiety around the issue, but you're actually making positive change. And the vast majority of action actually happens at the grassroots level locally. We may have these big global climate conferences and things, but at the end of the day, all of the actual action is reforestation here on the Banks Peninsula, which is fantastic, near Christchurch, or equivalent things at a regional level in countries across the world. So get involved in something that's addressing the issue close to you.
Because when we say global, really that's a collective of local.
It is.
So we don't have to go big and out of where we are to actually do something. In fact, it's often way more powerful to be doing something locally.
It is. You know, I think it's all very well talking about the UN and the World Economic Forum and all these big gatherings. But at the end of the day, look at what your city council or your local council or your local charity are doing to address their bit of the problem and work on that. And a tree planted where you are is the same as a tree planted somewhere else in terms of its ability to take carbon out of the atmosphere. And they all count.
They all count. Wonderful. Well, a very big thank you for being here today and sharing your experiences. It's truly inspirational, all the things that you have done and are doing. I can't wait to see what you do next. If you'd like to know more about Tim, his travels and his findings, please do go to www.timjarvis.org. Or you can check him out on social media. His Instagram handle is @timjarvisam. So find him there. And yes, wonderful to have you in the studio today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Terra Nova Earth Talks. For more information on the content and links from this podcast, go to the Terra Nova website. That's terranova.foundation. To listen to other interviews in this series, go to the Plains FM website. That's plainsfm.org.nz. Search for Terra Nova Earth Talks. Also on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Bye for now.